mind is a lot more public than you think. Have you ever felt that? You know, why is it, you know, people who know you reasonably well can go, oh, I know what you're thinking. Because there are so many other signals, aren't there? There's so many other signals. There's a sense of, you know, this is intimate, it's private, and what I'm thinking is just I'm holding this internally. No, it's not. It's written. It's written on you. It's written particularly, again, coming back to this sense of not mind and body. When we've got that disjunct of mind and body, almost a Cartesian dualism going, then of course it seems private. But actually if it's as it's spoken about in the text as savinya vijnana kaya, which actually means consciousness, mind, body, nothing else. That's actually the way that the Buddha speaks about it. You know, consciousness as this, you know, for all the ways we spoke about it this morning, and body. That's it. Yeah. And they're not separable. And also, there is no such thing as consciousness that's not embodied. Yeah. Very modern perspective. It's a non-religious perspective in these early texts. Doesn't remain the same throughout the history of Buddhism. You know, you can go to stuff within late Indian Buddhism, Japanese Buddhism, and find the idea of the separation of mind and body, and, you know, what's going to transmigrate, for example, is going to be consciousness. Well, the Buddha absolutely refutes this in these early texts. So there's an absolute linkage between the body and the mind. Yeah, again, even me using that conjunctive, and mind. You know, it's not there are two things that seem to happen to be, you know, coming together in this peculiar sort of way. The philosopher Gilbert Ryle once said, you know, wasn't it rather insulting to think of the body inflated by a mind, you know, in terms of human existence? And I think there is a rather derogatory way of thinking about human existence. You know, we are this mind-body. And so when we're looking at internal, external, it's seeing the mind being written on the body. It's there in our gestures, it's there in our intonations, it's there in what we contemporarily call body language. It's written. You know, it's not to say that, you know, everything is accessible, but, you know, if I'm going around like this, I don't need to ask you, are you feeling upset or miserable or that? I can see it. I can hear it in the intonation of your voice. So the body itself, the body-mind is a gesture of being in this world. It's a way, it's a gestural response to our context, our environment. Our context is obviously a context of all our connectedness with the world. So why is this thing that we're calling the mind going to be so private? Even what we use often to identify what's going on, so-called privately within the mind, is in the context of something which is public, called language. Have you ever noticed that? The stories you tell yourself, the ways of identifying mental processes, all of this is public. So I think what's actually going on in this internal external is, A, yes, I mean, I heard in the original question, you know, the sense of building up a degree of empathy, of connectedness with others. What's going on for them in similar ways is going on for yourself and vice versa. So there's that connectedness. But I think it's also breaking down the notion of privacy. You know, we live in an interpersonal connected world. It's really a very, very modern phenomenon where we think of ourselves as isolated minds. You know, there was, you know, pre-industrial revolution, pre-probably Renaissance, actually, we had much more of a sense of connectedness as community. The kind of questions that get asked post-Renaissance period weren't there in the early world. And certainly not in the medieval world, certainly not in the Greek world, there's much, much more of a sense of connectedness. What the Buddha is referring to is getting that sense of connectedness by understanding so much of what's going on for us is going on for you, both in terms of body, both in feelings, and in terms of mind, which we consider to be so intimate and private and personal. Actually, it isn't. A lot of it is written there for all to see, and it's that sense of connectedness with that. Because that opens us up to the empathetic response towards others. And I think we're going to go on and touch on this just a little bit this afternoon to talk about metta and karuna. What we term friendliness often gets translated into loving kindness, which is an appalling translation. Friendliness and this sense of compassion or kindness, which actually emanates out of metta, emanates out of this. If we've got no connected with others, and I can't read what's going on for you at all in terms of your mental processes, how am I going to feel connected to you? You're just so other as to be almost like an alien from another planet. You're not. You know, I'm not. You know, all of us can see something about the other's mental processes written in the language in a bigger sense that they live within the world and the way that we relate to our context and to those worldly processes. So this is the reason why I think the Buddha is emphasizing this internal-external split, which prima facie might seem rather puzzling. I don't actually think it's too puzzling when you think of it in those terms.
For me, the language of internal and external points to the deep importance of embodied listening. Embodied listening within the relational field, if you like. You know, the empathic field. And that sense that, you know, as a mindfulness teacher or a therapist or a partner or a parent or a friend, that actually, if we're really going to be there for somebody else, it requires that embodied listening, that mindfulness that is internal, yes, because it's embodied, and also external, because it's open to the relational field. You know, in some traditions they talk about the 50-50 awareness, where there's a full 50% of my attention soaking the body, inhabiting the body, and there's a full 50% in the relational field, deeply listening to, you know, the circle of people in the mindfulness class, or the client who's sitting there with me, or my parent, or my child. And when one's doing that, one gets a sense of how this listening is a quality of a willingness to resonate with the experience of others. You know, because don't we, when we are with other people in that sort of embodied way, we feel, as John was saying, we feel the energetics of what they're experiencing. You know, we may not be able to name it as a particular mood, but there's a felt sense of that, isn't there? We awaken into our deep relational sensitivity as human beings, which we spend a lot of time dissociated from and numb with, don't we? But actually, this is part of the immense gift that mindfulness is in relationship. And I love that sense of compassion as resonance. You know, as an embodied resonance. I sometimes think almost like you feel the body, maybe even right now, you feel the body, it's a bit like a cello or something. A musical instrument that has a sort of resonating chamber. You know how when you're near a piano and you make a noise and you hear there's a sort of reverberation in the piano? You know, it's almost like, okay, I choose to open this embodied field to an embodied empathy where, wow, somebody's sharing in the mindfulness group and I can feel the reverberations of what they're saying, you know, the joy or the sadness or the frustration, or the, you know, and that willingness to be available, you know, available to resonate with, which, is there a more beautiful human gift that we can give each other than the willingness to be available to resonate with each other's experience, you know, which is compassion. And it's lovely how you know, these two words for compassion in the early tradition, anukampa, which comes from the word anukampati, which means to tremble with. We could say almost like to resonate with, to vibrate with, to quiver with. So that receptive, resonant mind state, mind-body state. And then the other word, karuna, which has a more active sense of to spread out, to make, to do, which is the responsiveness. Because then we find as human beings that the more we're really resonating with and present for somebody else's experience, if there's suffering there, often there is an instinctive response that comes, or a desire to meet or to help alleviate or support that person. Sometimes just the resonance is enough as a response, of course. It's not like we have to do something, but there's a sort of intelligence in the human system that I think when we're really present for each other in an embodied, mindful way, when we really allow our system to resonate with somebody else's experience, often don't you find that the sort of the appropriate response arises somehow? And it's not premeditated. It's not, now what am I going to say to fix this person? You know, I think this is the deeper art of inquiry in mindfulness teaching, is actually to get out of the way of oneself. Rather than thinking, oh dear, where am I on Kolb's learning circle right now in this inquiry? Make sure I come out with the right... Yeah, and that just gets in the way, doesn't it? In terms of real inquiry. And actually the most beautiful inquiries are when there's just listening, there's just resonance, and somehow an appropriate response comes. And, you know, I just love that Zen story about... You know, the student asking the teacher, what's the goal of a lifetime of practice? Big question. You know, what's the goal of doing all this? And the answer comes back, an appropriate response. You know, so what if actually all of this mindfulness is about cultivating a capacity to respond appropriately, relationally, to what we meet in this life as human beings? You know, so that appropriate response comes out of the depth or the fullness of the resonance that we are able to offer offer in our relationship. Does that make sense? And we know those times when somebody says just the right thing. You know, a friend says just the right thing when we're struggling, or somebody just holds a door open for us when we're feeling a bit low. You know, and somehow it's an appropriate response. You know, just... has an intelligence within that situation that is just right somehow. You know, it's just grammatical within that moment somehow. It's just really helpful. And as teachers, to trust that, as therapists, to trust that if I listen deeply enough in an embodied way, the right response will come. Or a good enough response will come. You know, not the perfect response, but a good enough response. Which may just be silence, or may just be a gesture of empathy. And so this mindfulness internally and externally really feels like it is an invitation to compassion. An embodied invitation to compassion.